Barnaby.
Barnaby, yeah. Real name, John R. Barnaby. The R is not for Robert, it's for Robbins.
Yeah. Were you born nerd, or did you inherit this at a young age?
Okay, well, I was always into kind of engineering things, but I thought being a scientist was more significant in the world, and I majored in physics in college, which was a mistake, but I was far enough along, so I finished the degree anyway. But in my senior year in college, I took a course about computers.
Oh, cool.
And it was a bottom-up programming course. That was the first program you wrote went in an octal.
College was this?
Yeah, Harvard.
Harvard, huh? Yeah. So you were Harvard. East Coast? Are you West Coaster?
I'm an East Coaster. Oh. I came to California in 1971.
From Boston?
I was living in Cambridge then.
Cambridge.
Oh. Boston area. I mean, let's see, my family lived in Cambridge when I was born and moved to a suburb named Lincoln. One of the significance of Lincoln is that Lincoln Labs is there.
Yeah. Gotcha. So deep New Englander here.
Yeah. Then I went to Harvard and stayed in Cambridge. I worked at BBN, both Beranek and Newman, for several years.
Which is where Wes Clark was in 67 when they were designing the ARPANET.
And the Link.
I don't remember Wes Clark, but I remember people designing the ARPANET. They had little Lisp programs simulating the packets bouncing around, and there was a hardware group that designed the IMP.
Yeah, right.
That hardware group contained Severo Ornstein, who is the hardware designer of the Link. So when Wes was asked at the company, he was asked about the architecture and shown a diagram showing the mainframes all connected together.
Mm-hmm.
He said, no, you need a box in between that routes stuff and whatever, and you should base it upon the Link, which is in the barn here.
Mm-hmm.
And Severo Ornstein, who worked on that, also did the hardware for the IMP.
Mm-hmm.
So the IMP, and we were just at the Internet Archive, and there was a big chart on the wall showing early Internet topologies, and one of them showed the IMPs and all the systems tied into the IMPs. So it was a cool connection there.
It was. It was really interesting link.
Mm-hmm.
But you said you weren't really into computers until you took that course, and that sparked your imagination.
It was a fall semester course. Mm. In the spring semester, I found three courses to take about computers.
Wow.
One was on numerical analysis, one was on compiler writing. I don't remember what the third one was. Mm. But, it was more about methods of parsing and analyzing language, I think. Oh. Didn't actually code anything like a compiler.
Yeah.
But the course that started at the beginning, you put a program in an octal, and then you did a bunch of stuff in assembler. Hmm. And then they got a higher level language.
Did you work on the higher level languages as well as the assembler?
Yes, then, in that course. Okay. And in Fortran. But I got a part-time job at Paul Beranek and Newman in the spring of the senior year.
Hmm. What did you do there?
I wrote an assembler for PDP-1 on their hospital computer project.
PDP-1, remember that? You have the video of that.
Oh, yeah. Space War.
Yeah, it was the first Space War computer.
Did you play Space War on the PDP-1 while you were at
PDP? On the other PDP-1.
The other PDP-1.
Not the hospital one, huh?
No, because the hospital one was up almost all the time.
Oh, it was used constantly.
Yeah, being used by multiple teletype terminals. Whereas the other one, I think they left it on all the time. The first one they bought in a much smaller configuration had the graphic scope on it and often wasn't in use at night.
Lend itself to some fun.
Yeah. Yeah, except they wouldn't let anybody connect boxes into it, so you had to play with the test word switches. There's a little row of toggles like on an Altair. Tiny toggle switches.
So you played with 18 those.
Wide. Yeah.
You weren't able to play with any kind of a button or joystick or anything.
No, they powers that be drew the line of playing with the computer and connecting special hardware purely for toy purposes.
Yeah.
But you'd think connecting an outside box across the switches would be fairly well isolated.
Were you a hobbyist much at all in this stuff, or do you read these radio electronics magazines and do you try to build some of those Heath kits or whatever it was for at the time?
I was a hobbyist in analog electronics. Mm-hmm. Well, that and I had engineering assistant jobs in electronics in high school summers.
Mm-hmm.
Between junior and senior.
So you're no stranger to a soldering iron then, huh?
No. No, but it didn't come together until IMSI. Mm. You know, because it, both Beranek and Newman, the hardware was done by different people, and it was big and valuable.
Somewhat inaccessible.
Yeah, I mean, the most I ever fixed in the middle of the night at BBN was my teletype. Mm. But the teletypes are very failure prone, and you found a few of the adjustments to make.
Yeah. Were those ASR33s that you guys had?
Mostly we had KSR33s because we had this keyboard. No, paper tape.
No paper tape.
Because we had drum storage for programs and magnetic tape. And
was that like the late 69 or what?
It was 65 through 71.
Wow, that was during the ARPANET design.
Yeah, phase. Counting. I worked for two different divisions. First for the hospital project, which became some kind of an implied technology project. The people at the hospital, I guess they wanted more contact, more direct control over what they were doing. A couple of them finally learned to program and got a PDP, 15? PDP 11,
PDP 5 or 8 or... They never went above 11.
For sure they did. Was it 14 or 16 or something? A little, like 18-bit one, successor to the 1, or 16-bit or something. Gosh. Anyway, they got their own computers, and some of the doctors learned to program, and they got their own funding, and they wrote a higher-level language of a sort called MUMPS.
MUMPS.
Multiple user. Yeah. That was sold as a commercial service out here for a while into the 70s, I think into the 80s. Yeah. But it came from the people that decided to go independent at BBN and have their own computers at the hospital.
But what caused you to leave that whole scene and head west?
They laid me off when there was a low point in funding. And
you were there for a couple of years or a few years? Or?
BBN?
Yeah.
65 through barely into 71.
Mm, 6 years now.
Yeah. Just about, because it was like March or April 65.
Mm-hmm. And this was this was after college? Or?
Yeah. Well, the first year overlapped.
Yeah. You have a family by then?
No, still not have a family. Yeah. You know, I'm gay, and I really didn't confront it till after MicroPro.
Wow. So you're
getting into sex and coming out.
That's a whole San Francisco scene then, too.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was oblivious to the 70s part of the San Francisco scene. But
until the 80s,
Yeah, in 84 I moved into San Francisco.
It started getting dangerous.
I was living in Berkeley when I worked at IMSI. Well, Oakland and then Berkeley.
That was all way in chapter. So you were still not even looking at that aspect of your life until you came out west here to the Bay Area and the IMSI. Mm-hmm. So the IMSI world really opened you up, and a lot of things came together there.
Until I'd been here 10 years, basically.
Wow.
And I came in 71, and it was 81 that I came out.
Wow.
But one of the things that happened in between was that I felt some amount of career success with WordStar. And it was time to get some balance.
I'm kind of curious about how that unfolded. The whole WordStar story. How did that begin? You came out. You were looking for a job, I guess. After you got laid off.
I had some huge amount of money, like $7,000, in my checking account, and living like a hippie. That lasted quite a while.
I imagine. Yeah.
Somewhat like a hippie. Yeah. But because in Cambridge, I was pretty much working all the time, and just letting the money accumulate. Mm. But. No, I came out here to do the controls and some of the effects for sort of an art project, a dome in which lighting effects could be projected.
Really?
An artisty friend of mine who had been doing light shows through the 60s.
Really? So light show kind of, that's interesting.
Yeah. he took his best technologies. And he made a...
Pixel Music 3000. It's from the 70s.
Okay.
So music visualization? Because the big thing was oil back then,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that was one. Oil, and you do things manually.
Yeah.
Whereas this thing was automatic.
Automatic in the sense that it moved the oil, or...?
No, there were like half a dozen different things, and I made a programmer. Well, one of the things, actually the thing that connected me with this guy, yeah. was that when I moved out of, when my parents moved from the house we'd been children in, I collected the last of my stuff from it, and there was an oscilloscope, which I didn't have much use for then, so I connected to the stereo and found it was fun to watch.
Yeah, yeah, that was
you know, with first, some resistors and capacitors.
First high-tech light show, in a sense.
Yeah, so we, I wanted to be able to project it in the ceiling and lie back and watch it.
Yeah.
And so I eventually made a device with a laser and mirrors moved by speakers that sort of made a projection oscilloscope. Huh. And that was one of the devices in the dome.
Nice.
And then there was a thing with overhead projectors and wavy glass tiles and color wheels that made Ooh. Wonderful weaving
nice.
Weaving things.
Where was the dome set up? And
first in the Art Center at Berkeley for like 2 months or something, and then it, the next year it toured.
Was there a name for that project? Or was there...
Maybe I should have brought one. Well, I was packing for this. I came across the posters I saved from that show, but that I'd misfiled and hadn't been able to find when I wanted to show them to people.
What would have been the first technology-enabled dome?
Well, it's interesting because you know, I'm putting together some background for a documentary on the history of light shows.
Oh.
So I'm kind the guy of, that that's one of the other...
Did this was named Rick Meyer, mm-hmm. and Rick. Last I knew he lived in the South Bay somewhere in Mountain View or something. I guess we try Googling his name. I'm out of touch
Alan
now.
Alan worked on a dome at the US Festival for Steve Wozniak. A big video-enabled.
Well, and yeah, we were using four video projectors.
Four video projectors.
Okay. A little different.
Yeah, you could have recorded everything this thing did and reproduced just by playing video now.
Yeah, these days, yeah.
But
still, I mean, you were using real lasers and mirrors and...
There's mirrors that really had projectors. There was a thing with a light inside, a bunch of pieces of Mylar and a fan that made the Mylar flap in it.
Yeah, was it successful? Was it cool looking?
I think so. People liked it.
Oh, good.
People came and looked at it. Oh, and the whole surface, the dome was inflated, and anything you projected on it, you could see on either side.
You could see on the outside as well.
Yeah, so nice. Some things were in, and the bottom was all waterproof. Wow. You went in and lay down.
Cool.
Last I knew, this thing was rotting under the guy's deck. You know, what do you do with something like this?
Is it sort of a project for the Art Center for a season, and then you had to take it down after
Yeah,
that?
I think it ran the... Well, no, then he toured a bunch of California with it. He got small grants to do this.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't pay good money for the time. But he got, I don't know, the San Francisco Foundation or somebody to pay for the materials.
That was
and
the early
more.
70s, right? That's what brought you out here.
Yeah, that was 71. Hmm. So I think we talked about it Christmas 70. Hmm. And because we'd been sort of talking about this stuff because I'd made my first attempt to make a projection oscilloscope in his shop in Berkeley. Yeah. And discovered there was no way I could get a good a little dot through a little mirror out of a 500-watt bulb. Hmm. You know, a milliwatt laser worked much better.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can get a good dot through a big lens out of a 500-watt bulb, but you can't move that around with a small mirror that you can move at an audio rate.
Mm-hmm. And the lasers were portable enough now that and cheap enough that you could put them into stuff like that.
Right? Oh, now. Yeah.
And then they're still like maybe this big, right? Or sort of like a...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but there's a box with a laser and then the two moving mirrors, a piece of glass they projected through. And the lasers ran about 3 years and then stopped, and you had to order another one from Edmunds Scientific.
Right, Edmunds, yeah.
Oh, and we got a brighter one, a 2-milliwatt one or something for the dome.
They're all red in those days, too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and the thing was not precise enough to do things like spell text like you see people doing now.
Yeah, just make wild patterns.
Yeah, it just made interesting patterns that would pulsate with.
So your contribution to that was the programming for the laser and.
It was the laser.
The laser itself.
And then it was the electronics. Mm-hmm. Let's see, the first version of the programming was you put pieces of foil on the back of the audio tape, and it measured the duration. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be from 1/16 to 31/16 of an inch long or something. And that was what the code, and it measured the time the contacts were closed. And that was the code, which code number it was. And then, let's see, there were 8 circuits. There was a code to turn each one in, a code to turn each one off, and a master reset or something.
That was before any of the computers were out. It's all.
I think that must have been the first thing I did with digital logic. Yeah, it was all special purpose logic.
Yeah.
We actually used, rather than TTL, we used Motorola high threshold logic because we thought it had a better chance of working in an environment where there were lots and lots of phase controls. Because these things faded on and off. It had to plug into multiple circuits.
Were you the only nerd on the project? Were there other techies there then?
Yeah. No, I'd say I was the chief digital nerd. We were both nerds. Two of us did it. But
he was the analog one. You were the digital. So it was a good collaboration.
No, he was more the person who had the lighting effects and figured out how to make the dome and got some company to fabricate this huge thing, after he got some grant money.
Rick Meyer.
The organizer.
Wow, that's good for your history.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So that lasted for a summer for you, and then you were out here. And
then he toured the state with it.
And you didn't tour with him?
A number of museums, no.
That was
No, I thought I wanted to move on.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't have paid much money.
So you're looking for a real job at that point, I guess.
Let's see, did I look for... There was a point when I ran out of money, and I... 70 or 72, I looked for a job. I got a job with a company that was trying to make a softwareless computer. I mean, I just went through personnel agencies. Yeah. And that sounded like such an intriguing idea that I worked for them to see what it was. Yeah. And, of course, it wasn't softwareless. It was the software that was supposed to be hidden behind a human interface and be all pre-written. Yeah. Reminded me, what was that thing?
Like an EEPROM or something like that.
I mean, there was a mini computer buried in the thing. It just put up your multiple choices for what you wanted to do with your data on the screen, and it had some sorting hardware or something, and it was supposed to make it real fast for business processing.
Yeah.
I don't know. It ran out of money and didn't get anywhere.
Yeah. So you quickly moved on to that, I guess. So.
I bought an old house to fix up and sell. Borrowing some money from my father, and I ended up having 3 fix-ups in Berkeley going simultaneously.
Wow,
that's pretty industrious.
And I got over-involved in the last one, so I moved into it. And so by holding it for 10 years, it worked out fine. But it looked like what we thought we could sell it for was above what we had in it. Before I did that.
So then you were living in Berkeley at that point, then,
yeah.
I guess you took that place. What was that, about 74, 73, 74?
Let's say it was 75. I moved into the house, in 84 I sold it.
Oh,
74. So it was like the dome would have been summer 71. Fixing up houses was 72, 73, 70.
73, Berkeley. The main nerd I knew then was Berkeley was Fred Sisson.
That's system, right.
Berkeley nerd.
Right.
Okay. Berkeley microcomputers.
Oh.
Time.
No, I was out of touch a bit. And then, 78-ish, I think I was running out of money, and somebody told me IMSA I was hiring.
78. Had you been tracking the computer?
77,
computers coming up?
Not really. No, I didn't know about this stuff until I went. I heard this place was hiring and went down there.
And you found out about the IMSA.
Wow, that's pretty neat. Yes. Because one thing it did was it let me bring my hardware and software experience together.
Huh.
Software-wise, the strength of my experience was I was always good at cramming a lot into a small memory in assembler.
Mm-hmm. More for less.
Yeah. It wasn't till the 80s that I found the memories were big enough so the program you could develop was limited by the complexity you could debug rather than the complexity you could make small enough to fit into the memory. Hmm.
So, and IMSI stood for
International Microcomputer Systems Associates Incorporated.
We think. Check the
that
Wikipedia. Sure, they have a lot of that basic information.
And they were over in the peninsula.
Yeah, off Marina Boulevard, where they were making all the traffic going off 8080 today.
Oh yeah.
No, they weren't. Marina Boulevard was the exit, but the road they were on, I think, had right angles to that.
What phase were they at when you interviewed with them? Had they been around for a year or two
something like that, I think.
Yeah. So they had.
They were about to bring their first floppy disk to the market.
First floppy. Okay. So that was about the time that I guess Woz was making his.
Yeah, 78 was when the Woz floppy came out. Spring of 78.
I may have the dates wrong on the tip of my tongue.
So the floppy was a big deal at the time. It was the first time that these machines could easily load and
there was a question of getting a system to put on it. And there were proposals or samples or something. Of
system, you mean like operating systems?
Yeah. I mean suddenly it gets useful.
Yeah.
The file system particularly. I just read about CPM and said, that's the one we want of all the things that crossed my desk.
So once you were at MSI, that's what you chose for them?
Yeah. That's what I proposed. I mean, the decision was made further up, but I said...
The CPM, Gary Kildall had written it.
Yeah.
How did it find way into your consciousness at MSI?
Some description of it with somebody, I suppose you'd already sent it to IMSA.
Okay.
I mean, it was already there.
Yeah, it was pretty
somebody
well established by 78. It was,
not really.
79.
I think those dates are wrong.
I think 77, well, because CPM...
Actually, there may be an old resume of mine on a disk in the computer. 76 sounds more right.
Yeah, because CPM's first machine it was on was... MSI, wasn't it developed for MSI?
No, it was developed, I think, for hypothetical 8080. It was old.
Okay.
CPM may be were the... No, MSI, I think, were the first people to sell it.
Yeah.
And sort of made it become the standard.
Yeah, I think that's true.
But the code was all there, and he had some kind of homemade or something 8080 systems.
Hmm. It ran on the 8080 pin.
Yeah.
Eventually, it ran everywhere. I mean, it ran on from ENCOs and
Those were all either
polymorphic
8013,
and then of course the Osborne. I mean, it was running everywhere.
It was Osborne, yeah. It was big until
It was the same processor.
The operating system of choice for years.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little piece you put into it that has your read and write a sector, input a character, output a character, print a character. Functions
PCA, what's that?
A little bias. Print a character.
Print a character.
Many thought it was superior to MS-DOS when MS-DOS came out.
Well, I programmed on a CPM machine
back
in that period, and I thought it was great. And then I went to computer land to try an IBM PC, and I was like, this is just a dumbed-down, limited version of CPM.
Yeah, CPM was more mature.
Well, it had a hierarchical, file structure. I don't think DOS 1.0 had a hierarchical file structure.
CPM didn't either, to my memory.
By the time I was using it,
it wasn't terribly important on a quarter megabyte floppy.
So what was your initial job there at MSI?
Let's see, what did I do first? I remember writing some BIOSes to get it to work on disk. I remember fixing some bugs. You know, they had a 4K and an 8K basic. You know, which you either had in ROM or you loaded a paper tape every time.
Mm. Yeah, the paper tape, yeah.
I remember fixing some bugs in them.
Mm-hmm. Then it came time to get the floppy and then the software that would work with the floppy.
Yeah, and then it soon became CPM.
And then CPM
was the main software.
You had recommended that to them and they
went for
that.
It.
And then you were involved with implementation of CPM on the MSI?
Mm-hmm.
Was that a straightforward process?
I think the first version was pretty straightforward. Uh-huh. But one thing we did, you'll notice my machine signs on MDOS for Inside DOS.
Oh.
And under the license for CPM, we had the source code and the right to modify it. Uh-huh. The whole damn part that ran in RAM and recoded in an assembler and made it about half as big.
Wow.
And then filled the space up with new features. Like there was something I always thought was important called option bits, that I called option bits. I mean, almost any time you have a call to the system to perform some function, they're usually variations. And either you have a humongous number of them or you have a word of option bits. And I notice what's become of that is Microsoft calls them style bits. And they almost always have style bits in one of their Windows system calls.
So what was the significance of them? What were they?
Just for anything any little variations you wanted in basically the same call. You know, you need several places to put flags. Because usually they're on-off, they're one-bit things. And these were called in assembly were the things in the registers, so you didn't want a big long argument list because you'd have to have a pointer to a memory block. But, I mean, all the systems people wrote at BBN had option bits, style bits, something like that. You know, it's like when you're inputting a character from the keyboard, do you want the system to echo it, or do you want to echo it yourself? That's one to send back to your, do you want it to be sent to your console device, or are you doing that yourself?
So putting the CPM...
Do you want to wake up the program on every character typed, or only on certain break characters?
You need it.
Yeah. And of course that leads into a lot of the fundamentals in WordStar was the, well, let's we'll get to that later. So it's fitting CPM onto the M side.
So once you had the OS going, then it was time for the software, which included WordStar.
Yeah.
This was going to be one of the...
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a little later. Because one of the things that came was once you were working with an operating system, you didn't, and you had a debugging program, you didn't debug programs from the front panel anymore or input them through the switches.
Mm-hmm, which is a big breakthrough, right? And
yeah, so they dropped the front panel. So yeah, that was about the most expensive board in the computer.
Oh, and those switches always fall off anyway, right?
Well, apparently, judging from the fact that the one in the museum in Mountain View is missing a switch, and one of yours is missing a switch, I don't know. I don't remember if they always fell off from me or not.
Well, how many times did you switch them yourself?
Not very often.
Yeah.
Not very. I was accustomed to programming in assembler on a time sharing system, you know, where the hardware was user proof. If you tried to halt the machine or something, it threw you off and kept running the other people with a symbolic debugger. Mm. You know, they got all the symbols in from the compiler and linker. So I tried to move that way on...
You can understand how the switches could actually be switching them thousands of times.
Yeah, and I don't... I don't know. I never learned to read any machine's instruction set on the lights.
Yeah.
I don't know them in hex because I have a program that prints the opcodes.
Yeah, took the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
So once CPM was up, was WordStar one of the did you help develop it, or was it a package that you bought from a third party initially?
No, WordStar was later.
It was later. Okay, so. So you had the operating system up, and then you had...
We had the editor that came with CPM, which was a line editor.
So text line editor of some kind?
Yeah.
Did they use that?
Actually, somebody made a snide comment about not being able to use the screen like you can on a slaw.
Okay. Oh.
And I said, I bet I can do better than that, and I wrote a version of the text editor that gave you a mode to the full screen display.
So 80 columns?
With XY.
Like this off?
Well, whatever.
Upper lowercase. I mean,
whatever the hardware you're using was.
Yeah.
Like, Alan, you used electric pencil, right, on the saw, or?
It was on the saw, yeah.
I never did.
Electric pencil.
Yeah.
That was one of the first word processors, really.
Yes,
you must have had that running on the M side as well.
No.
No?
No, but I knew about it because this Rick Meyer friend of mine worked for Processor Technology.
Oh, we did? Okay.
Yes.
So that was part of his history.
And he was producing documentation, I think, and when electric pencil became available, he gobbled that right up and got all these people typing on computers instead of typewriters.
Yeah.
But, and then one day they went to work and they told them the company was closed down.
Oh.
Effective today.
Oh.
And there never was much explanation of that.
I mean, closing down Processor Tech?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was very abrupt.
Now, Lee...
Because it was privately held. Need to explain it.
Lee tells a bit of that story in the... That we did. He did 2 years ago, the 30th anniversary of Processor Tech. Yeah.
Okay, but one day they put them all in a bus and showed them new quarters, and they got a big building so they could expand. And then a few months or a couple of years or something later, it just all sort of ended.
Wow.
Quite abruptly.
Wow. But for you, things were just getting going at MSI, right?
I forget what the processor
the CPM
tech
was up, and I guess Processor Tech was.
Yeah, and I wrote this editor, and I could see the writing on the wall that IMSI wasn't going to last real.
Really?
Real long.
What made you feel it was going to go away?
We knew the owner was starting Computerland. Noticed that anything you make, somebody makes cheaper in their garage 6 months later. And IMSI didn't want it to be maybe like Godbout of He wasn't interested in being a lowball company. You know, he wanted to have a big company with a sales staff and nice offices and stuff.
What was his name?
Bill Millard.
Bill Millard. Now, you also...
Yeah, well, and to be able to pay a good salary to the CEO, of course.
You also told me about the culture of Inside. They were all Est followers of...
Oh, yeah, they're
right. Est, right?
Yes. Est, yeah.
Explain to the audience what Est is. And
oh, I don't
Werner
know.
Erhard's.
Did you take the course yourself?
Many years later, yes.
Yeah.
But in the 80s.
The early...
what do they call them?
I refer to them as S-holes.
S-holes.
Because one thing I tell you in the training is if you want to be an asshole, go ahead. Be yourself.
Yeah, I remember S, yeah.
Yeah.
So their whole thing was when things disappeared, they disappeared, or something like that. You mentioned before the philosophy of...
There was the tendency that when you wanted to end a relationship, it was good to end it fast. Mm-hmm. And they somehow perverted that into... if there's an employee you don't want anymore, you call them in and say, you're fired, leave now.
Yeah.
But I did a control trip on them to the extent that I told them, I'm giving you 2 weeks' notice today. And I made it stick.
Okay.
I was in the middle of a lot of things they wanted, and they let me finish them.
Well, that's interesting. So you've got the another lifestyle element in here, the coming out of the closet and new technology all at the same time here in the Bay Area. What was your social life like then? Were you
not much.
You're still a major nerd, just focusing on work and getting working on deadlines and getting them.
It's only been recently as I get more into exercise that my body will function on a 24-hour day. It wants to run in a 24-and-a-half-hour day or 25-hour day.
Yeah.
Just enough so you're all out of sync by the end of the week, but not enough to drop a day every week.
Yeah. Huh. Okay, so you're really focused on work, pretty much.
Yeah.
And so this, how long was the stint at MSI? Was it 5 years?
It was not that long. Huh? Let me not give dates off the top of my head.
Okay, but shorter than that.
Yeah.
I guess
a couple of years or something. I think a lot of that information's on the web, or I can dig it out of old resumes and get it to you another time.
Okay, well, I guess so. Looking at the milestones, really, like the next milestone after the text editor. I guess the floppy drives were up. The operating system was working on it.
Yeah, and the text editor was a while later.
Text editor, and then what came next after that?
Somewhere in there, the marketing director Seymour Rubinstein quit.
He was a marketing director. Seymour was a marketing director over at MSI.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, did you know him?
He worked there, and he was capable of recognizing smart people and could sometimes get what he wanted, but on the software by talking to me.
And he was marketing director. Okay.
Yeah, he was hired quite a while after I was. I forget which one of us left first.
Okay, well, that's interesting, because that kind of ties in with your WordStar.
Yeah, because I did some work with Berkeley Solar Group, my brother's little company, immediately after being at IMSI.
And this was during the energy crisis crunch of the late 70s, right? So solar power was in, like it is now.
Yeah, and there was government funding for stuff like that.
Yeah.
And with ever since Proposition 13, they've been cutting stuff like that back. I mean, it was starting to be very hard to get grants. That's what the company basically ran on. Awesome. California Department of Energy grants.
Okay, but this was after you were at IMSI for three or 4 years.
Really. Well, the company overlapped. But I went and did. And by that time, they had their first eclipse. And
they had an eclipse, a general eclipse?
Yeah.
Wow, cool.
Well, that was because as two hippie-looking graduate students, they went to DEC and asked for information about buying a PDP, and DEC didn't take them seriously. But Data General did, so they bought a Data General machine. And then you remember the book, The Soul of a New Machine, about the development?
Yeah. Yeah, that was classic.
Yeah, my brother's company had serial number 5 of that machine.
Of the Data General machine?
Yeah, of the machine that book was about.
Which was the eclipse. Yeah.
Well, it was a later eclipse. I forget what it was called.
Yeah, Soul of a New Machine. I remember that. Was that Frank Rose?
Yeah, I mean, they had a little, a little mini computer eclipse in a panel, and it had another thing in a rack panel that held a 5 megabyte removable disk or something. Then they got a big disk the size of a washing machine, and it required three-phase power, and PG&E had to install a thing on the outside of the building that apparently was a motor generator that made three-phase power out of two-phase, because there wasn't any three-phase power in the neighborhood.
Yeah, that's how the Cray 1 supercomputer needed three-phase and a motor generator set.
Well, that was a mini computer, wasn't it? They were going head-on-head with PDP.
Yeah, they were a bunch of PDP people. Like Zilog were a bunch of Intel people.
And where were they located? Where was the...
Don't know.
No? So, let me get clear on the story. You ran into the Data General stuff while you were at MSI, or was this...
This is what my brother did.
Your brother with the solar...
Yeah,
Okay.
Yeah. Well, my brother came to Cal Berkeley to get his architecture degree.
Okay.
But he kind of followed me. And he... Two students and a professor started this little company, and a few years later I worked for them a bit. Mm-hmm. And sometimes later I worked with them some more.
Okay. So they came back. So they were there.
I did for MicroPro, I did at home.
And how did that come about? How did the WordStar thing begin for you? Were you had left MSI by then?
I had left MSI and kept in touch with Seymour. He said he wanted a text editor.
He knew you had done one on the MSI?
Yeah, I'd seen it. I'd seen it on the MSI, and he wanted another one to run under CPM that you could sell to the general market. And he knew about business programming, which I didn't, and he suggested writing a sort program. Huh. And he enumerated a whole bunch of little features it should have. Hmm. And I remember I came up with a way to tie all the little features together using an interpreter inside the thing. There was a sort of a virtual language, a little like P code, but it would do with the sort program I do, and by having different kinds of keys, different ways of comparing things, and a full merge as well as a sort capability would do an incredible variety of stuff. Yeah. But the market didn't really go for it. It was never, to my knowledge, moved to the IBM PC. Yeah.
So what did he? What did you first ended up doing for him? A more fancy text editor?
I did the text editor and the short program overlapping.
And the short program overlapping.
Yeah, and both at once.
When did it? When did
at home?
Huh. That was at home.
Yeah.
You were doing it on an MSI that you got from MSI.
Yeah.
And when did
on this machine up in the truck?
I believe I have the machine and the keyboard that I got from MSI. And because later I had two of them. Yeah. You know, because I didn't have a symbolic debugger, so you needed assembly listing printouts to be able to debug best. And the immediate straightforward way to be able to print without tying up your whole computer was to have a second computer to drive the printer.
Gotcha.
You're moving the stuff back and forth in floppies. So I got the big line printer that's in the truck. And MSI bought me the other... MicroPro bought the other system, I believe. The second one, so I could either one at home and one at work, or two in one place two at home when I was really pushing in something.
So did this initial program, was it the basis for WordStar? I mean, did Seymour call it WordStar at that point, or did he have a
team? No, the first text editor was, the basic distinction between a text editor and a word processor is a word processor adds word wrap.
Word wrap and...
So you can type a whole paragraph and it will format it into lines. Whereas a text editor for source programs generally doesn't do that.
Gotcha, yeah.
Because the lines need to begin where the next command begins.
Yeah, and I guess printout, sophisticated printing capabilities to make a good word processor.
Yeah. Seymour suggested word wrap.
Word wrap.
And I looked at it and decided it would need a print function also. He didn't particularly do, because when you're doing a program source file, usually you just copy it to the printer. It looks the same on the screen. Whereas the word processing has more stuff embedded in it that you don't want to see in the printer.
Did you look at like professional systems like Wang and DEC, or you just
sort of... No, we just sort of bowled ahead. I occasionally come across a manual and want to read it, but I don't think I ever got much of a chance to play with one.
So it was really, you were clean slate in a sense to do words. Now the predecessor for WordStar was called what? It was called
WordWrap.
No, there was the program editor that was Ned at MSI for new editor, because the CPM editor was Ed.
And had MicroPro been started yet?
let's see, MicroPro got started while I was doing development at home, and he eventually borrowed some offices from a friend.
In San Rafael?
Yeah. No, this was in, what's that place? It's over a few more hills up north on 101.
Fairfax?
Nevada?
No, it's on 101, beyond Nevada.
Petaluma?
More.
Santa Rosa?
Just short of Santa Rosa.
Oh, my.
Sebastopol?
No, it's a created development town. Oh. It may come to us.
Nicosia?
Nah, I think it's only two syllables.
So then MicroPro... So
you go up a long hill and you go down and then you kind of go like this and then there are a couple of exits.
Yeah. So it's a very small little town, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it, the general area.
It's just that he had a friend who had a commercial building there that he wasn't using all of.
Okay, so he used to there and he started using his marketing and PR skills for creating a new company and he decided that he'd release a word processor as his first product?
No, it was his third product.
Third product, okay.
Because he had the editor and Supersort were the ones that first bootstrapped the company.
Okay, so it was a...
Do you have a collection of old issues of Byte?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Got them all.
Just leaf through it, look for Bright Purple.
Bright Purple.
He made an ad about as big as one of these pages and put a very bright purple border around it.
Okay.
For a full page ad. And it was just fine print full of technical details and where to order this stuff from.
Okay.
And at the time, you could ask people to pay in advance. And if they wanted to, if they claimed they were a dealer and they wanted a sample, well, no, you got to pay for it. Well, don't I get a discount? Yes, if you buy five.
Yeah.
And it worked. You bootstrapped the company.
So what were these, do you remember the prices those days for this stuff?
For those things, no. WordStar was
$495. $495?
Yeah. And stayed that way for a long time.
Wow. Yeah, so it was a pretty premium product, though.
Yeah, well, you have to sell it to somebody who's going to see the obvious productivity improvement. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot cheaper than buying, especially if you already have, well, A, if you're buying a computer, it doesn't add that much to it. If you already have the computer, it suddenly makes it useful.
Well, I know. I remember we had a dedicated deck writer. It was, they're like $10,000, $15,000 just to buy one.
Yeah, and the alternative is to buy like a $4,000 or something IMSI.
Yeah, and buy this program for $500.
Buy a $500 program, and you know the dealer could put all that together for you.
Yeah.
But actually, I believe I have the. Don't I? Where are they? Papers with the prices I paid for the stuff.
So, and you worked at home with your MSI, mm-hmm. writing the initial code for this, and you did the text editor, which is one of his first products. Before?
Yeah, the text editor and the Supersort.
And you did the Supersort as well?
Yeah.
Did you work with other programmers, or was it...
He hired another programmer. We worked together a bit. He did support stuff and installations. So there was all the stuff you needed to get coded for specific installations.
Wow.
Hmm. Yeah, because every printer was different. You still have that with...
I mean, it's one of the headaches is writing drivers for all the printers out there.
No, the first headache was reading a whole lot of printer manuals and finding the common denominator. What are the things that all the printers can do that you expect the program to support? You know, the program has to call a few entry points in the driver package and get the printer to do all the things it wants.
Mm-hmm. It's got to do formatting, proportional spacing.
Proportional spacing was way primitive.
Yeah.
But because it was, I never really mastered the screen fonts, printer font issue. Hmm. I mean, on the inside of the screen was text, and so it was fixed size. Hmm. So the only proportional spacing it had was it would... There was a relatively undocumented, unpublicized feature that would adjust the relative widths of the characters by proportional spacing and then expand or contract the line to fit the width. Because it wasn't doing the line breaks by proportional spacing because the line breaks on the printer and on the screen were the same.
Hmm. Well, I guess screen those days, you couldn't have an accurate view of the fonts either because
it was a text screen.
Yeah.
It was 25 by 80
so you had
or
to,
whatever.
You could try to do bold. Right, or you could do reverse video to show something, but use that for marking text blocks, right?
The screen generally had some kind of highlight.
Some kind of highlighter.
Yeah, usually rear video. It often had bright also. Huh.
Yeah, bright sometimes uses bold.
Yeah. Let's see. And these, what did you do for underline on the screen? You generally didn't.
You had a marker.
Mark at the beginning and end of the underline.
Yeah, but yeah, how did you display it? I think it just showed the characters. I don't even think there was a way to turn those off.
So you had to look lowest common denominator, printers, screens, and keyboards, right?
Yeah.
For all across all these CPM boxes.
Yeah, well, the keyboard was well defined. It was ASCII.
But I mean, you had to choose the arrow key.
Yeah, I had to choose which ASCII key character was the universal. And then I put away a way to put in additional characters.
And then the control Q, control K was all because you always had control key in all the keyboards.
Yeah, control key. You didn't have an alt key.
Yeah. So
you didn't have any function keys that were across all the terminals.
Control became really important. Control key.
Mm-hmm.
That was your escape code to getting
control
command.
PS, control.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So what? Any other big headaches in this getting it out the first time?
Let's see. Another one of the things I ran into was trying to make the cursor move in a constant print column. Because although the lines were formed on the screen, their length varied because you had things like control characters to turn boldface on and off that took up space on the screen.
Yeah.
It didn't on the printer. So often when you go cursor down, I decided that should go to the same place on the printed page, which made it jog left or right.
Oh, but it was true to where it was going to be on the printer.
Yeah. Yeah, it would help you visualize.
What were the cursor key combinations for WordStar?
The generally available one was a diamond. I need to look at a keyboard.
Yeah, that whole.
So for the visual cursor, but the cheat sheets that you see stuck onto keyboards that show the up, down, left, right combos. Mm-hmm. What were those? There was the A character. And
well, A is left word. The next one over is left character. The next one over is right character. I think of them as motions, not as letters. Without a keyboard in front of me, I can't quote them to you as...
How did you get into the movement mode?
How did I get into the pattern?
How do you get into where you're moving the cursor around? Is it a control key to start?
No, it's always in that mode.
It was always.
Unlike the editor I wrote, had a command mode that worked like, that used commands similar to the CPM editor. For things like search and so on.
What was that editor?
And then
that was Ned? That was Ned, or was it?
It was Ed on CPM, and I called it Ned, and then MicroPro called it Wordmaster.
Wordmaster, okay.
And that one, you know, you had a command line, and if you typed a V or something, it went into screen mode. Yeah. But if you wanted to do a search, you had to go back to the command mode.
So in WordStar, getting into screen mode, I mean, if you're using the A key, how do you know you're not typing the letter A?
If you just use the A key, you are typing the letter K. If you want it to move the cursor, it's Control A.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's a control.
Control is the key for.
Because in WordStar, I put in video interfaces for all the commands and took out the command mode for all the functions, all the Control K, Control Q, etc. stuff that you've been talking about. There were three or four control keys that each brought up a menu.
Gotcha.
And there was a cut and paste using control keys too, I believe.
Yeah,
that was control K, wasn't it? Something or other?
Most of the block stuff was in the control K menu.
And you could also...
There was a mark beginning, mark end, move the block here.
You could write a block to the new file, and that was always a cool feature when I used WordStar. You know, mark a block, write it to a file?
Yeah.
That was inspired. That was like a clipboard, having a clipboard.
It was like having a number of clipboards if you can remember the name of the files.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Slight detail.
Okay. Because, I sort of didn't like the concept of just one buffer. Hmm. So I went for the files thing.
Mm-hmm.
The putting it to a file. So there wasn't an invisible buffer. Or
everything was...
There wasn't cut and paste separately. There was move and copy.
Yeah,
you know, I know these things can be really open-ended in terms of finishing. How did you decide when you were done with version 1.0? I mean, do you have a feature set that you just had to have?
Kind of. I think there was a computer show coming up, and we showed what we had as version 0.93, and sold a bunch of them.
Whoa. Huh. Was that at the West Coast Computer Fair in...
I don't remember.
'78 or...
That sounds pretty plausible.
So how did it initially do when you figured out? Was it?
People liked it. People bought enough of them to keep the company going.
Yeah.
And expand it. And I think eventually we thought of selling updates, but we never got it like Microsoft. You know, where every year or two, you buy, if it was a $500 program, you buy a new one for $75 or $100 every year, or every 2 years. That nobody realized it would progress so rapidly that that was the way to make money.
Right, the updates.
You get to, as a user, I see that a whole lot because you're not quite sure if it's good, if it'll really work for you before you buy it. But once you've got it, you know it's good. Yes, you want to improve it. Yes, I see this list of new features. I want those things. It makes sense as a way to make it attractive for people to spend money on your product.
Yeah. Did you have much competition for a while, or was it?
One of the things that surprised me was that there wasn't a lot. I thought software would be like hardware. You come up with something good and somebody else will copy it.
Yeah.
And then you'll leapfrog it a little bit in 6 months and it'll be over and you'll have to rush around to write another one.
And you didn't find that to be the case with the software,
no.
Huh?
No. No, not with WordStar. Huh. I mean, just more and more people wanted to put in their equipment and adapt it to their printer.
Yeah, you had more and more, can it work with this, can it work with that kind of question. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And mostly it was, yes, it'll work, but if you want all those special function keys on your keyboard that's in different codes from everybody else's, you've got to do this. Hmm. And, you know, there's a copy of the customization notes in the truck that told you how to do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, or the other programmer at MicroPro would do it for them, usually, particularly if it was an OEM rather than a user or a dealer. You know, they're making some deal to buy them in quantity. Yeah. MicroPro would do the customization.
Did you feel like you had a fair deal with MicroPro? I mean,
I think I had the deals I made.
Yeah.
The deals I made paid me a lot for a small number of copies, and then ended because I assumed the stuff wouldn't keep selling.
So it was kind of a surprise to see how it kept selling for so long. Huh?
Yeah. Well, then I wanted salary for a while. And then I wanted to slow down, and that really wasn't possible in salary, so I left. Hmm. I mean, if I'd made a different deal, it might have dribbled on for quite a bit longer.
Yeah.
But I did go back. They wanted WordStar put on one of the first laptops that didn't have a disk. Hmm. It just said, you know, you change programs by changing a ROM.
Oh, that was the grid.
The grid system.
In fact, I was running WordStar on the grid compass.
No, this one was some Japanese company.
Oh.
That,
like Toshiba.
I cut the thing down from, some, Toshiba. And I think took out the file commands. Where did you save your work? It didn't have floppies in it.
Some ROM memory scratch space?
Maybe it did.
Flash? Yeah. Like a...
I don't remember what it had, but I know I made WordStar work in this funny little... WordStar and ROM work in this funny little computer.
Yeah.
I mean, you had to get all the ROM and RAM separated more clearly. Hmm. I think that was mainly what I did. Than it had been. And WordStar had overlays, and it had to be simplified enough so it would all stay in ROM at once, because I believe it ran in the ROM.
Okay, so WordStar ran with overlays, so you would...
Yeah, Word at 1.0 didn't, but pretty soon it did. And there were people that didn't like the latency and...
So it would load different parts of the program when it was trying to do different things?
Yeah, maybe if you print it would go to a different... Or at least for the dialogue, it would go to a different overlay. Whenever a menu came up, you'd hear the disk clunk.
Oh, now you told me also originally that
you could turn the menus.
Very long files. There was a problem for a long time with long, long, long files, right?
Yeah, there was an obscure bug that I used the first few times I encountered it. I assumed my machine had dropped a bit. Huh. And I finally, maybe it was while I was doing this thing for the Japanese company, it was a logic bug. There was a greater than that should have been a greater than or equal or something. The logic bug of mine had been in the field for years.
But what did this bug do when it...
If you backed up far enough in a file, if something you'd done ended exactly in a multiple of 128 bytes, and then you went a long way back, it scrambled your file. It moved all the characters 128 bytes or something.
Oh, my.
I think it doubled a piece and lost a piece and left the rest. But, you know, you'd have to have a good printout to... Or go back to a backup.
So you saved it. Now, it was paging from disk through the file?
Yeah.
So the, it would fuss it up as you were going.
Yeah, you could.
When they hit that problem and you were backing up, it would be paging the characters back out to disk as you were paging.
Yeah, I'm not sure paging's quite a proper technique. Spooling.
Spooling.
I don't know. It kept the part of the file. Because one of the things you would do is you would edit a file as big as a floppy disk.
Right.
Which was much bigger than the RAM.
Right.
You could actually read from one disk and write to another if you wanted.
Yeah, I think I did that.
Yeah.
Just for a safety measure.
And that...
Because you keep your programs on one disk and your data files on another.
But you could even read your Word, Word Star document from one disk and write it to another.
Yeah, but usually you kept it smaller than half a disk. I mean, by having a document for each chapter or whatever. A file for each chapter of your document.
So it would load a lot faster.
Or something. Well, it's just handier to work with. Because you want to put the WordStar system and your file on one disk, usually.
Yeah. This was before the days of automatic backup, too. You had to choose to...
When you edited it, it renamed your old file to back.
Oh, right.
That came from CPM.
Because I remember losing a whole bunch of files once and having to retype them from listings.
Yeah, if you don't keep the... Or if you get a file scramble and you edit a few times before you notice it, the automatically created back file is the next older version. That would also have the problems in it. Yeah. So we were talking about how the file buffering worked. The file it reads from is the original file. I can't rewrite to that. So if you make modifications and go backwards... backwards more than the amount that fits in RAM, then it had to write the part it backed up over to yet another file,
mm-hmm.
a backup file. And then when you went forward again, it copied out of that file until it had it all, and then it would continue copying out of the original file.
So as the user's scrolling around and they're noticing all this scrambling, they're actually rewriting their original file.
No, the point is they're not rewriting the original file. It uses yet another file for backup.
Another file. So if you were if you're smart about it, you would... Say, okay, don't save this. Let's go back to our original file.
Yeah, well, there's a command for finishing the edit, essentially finishing the edit to start
Control
it over.
Control K, Control S, was it? Control Q, Control S, because you were quitting and saving.
No, KQ was just quit. KD was save and end the edit. KS was save and start over. It would do all the same file stuff as if you... finish the edit and then call the file up to edit again.
And we also talked about before that I remember the WordStar I used had actually showed the list of files.
Yeah.
For the commands.
And
that's the sort of thing Seymour thought of. It would never occur to me that was an important
issue. It's like a little file manager mode was in there. Probably an overlay that did that. Right?
Yeah. When you're not editing.
The top of the screen, right?
Usually the menu's the top and the files were at the bottom.
The files were listed in the window.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Remember that?
You could scroll down through them and pick it.
Yeah, it was cool.
I thought that would be a good interface. So. Yeah, I used it. It was fun. You didn't have to go to DOS mode.
Cursor into the files might be an addition. I don't remember doing that. Hmm. I think probably when I was working on it, it showed the file names, but you had to type it when you wanted.
Hmm. Yeah, I think there was a scroll function.
Yeah, eventually you could.
Oh, yeah, it would scroll them, but it didn't put the cursor into them. I mean, it didn't let you choose from them.
So
it didn't occur to me that you couldn't retype your own 8-character file name.
Who worked on WordStar after you left?
Must have been a team working on it.
Was there a whole team took it
on? Oh, they had a huge team to do WordStar 2000.
Yeah. Did they try to go onto the PC?
Oh, they did go onto the PC. Version 3 ran on the PC.
So that was a big push then, to get that in?
Yeah, I wasn't involved. But that was what I was saying. I thought was a giant waste of an opportunity to make the PC do exactly what the 8080 did, instead of trying to enhance the product at the time.
Yeah.
He said my customers like this make it do exactly the same thing, and he had a programming shop in Ireland do a bunch of this stuff.
Because I remember there was quite a push by all the different word processor groups to become the de facto standard on the PC.
Mm-hmm.
Well, didn't John Draper?
Yeah, Information Unlimited Software was working on EasyWriter version, and that was his top secret project.
He wrote that while he was in prison, didn't he?
No, he did the original version while he was in prison, on the Apple II.
John Draper.
But then the PC version was done at his apartment in Berkeley.
Because IBM went around and they signed up companies for the launch. They put them under strict secrecy agreements.
Yeah, they were under very strict secrecy.
And then the day that it was launched, as I remember this, there was like this show Charlie Chaplin with carrying this stack of boxes of software. Like, this is how much software They were smart about getting those guys signed up.
Yeah, you know, I wonder, you know.
Peachtree and all these other companies I'd never heard of were suddenly.
They had all that stuff.
Peach Text, remember that?
I'm not sure which one actually won out on that. I guess it was.
Seems like WordPerfect did well.
They did.
More
Easy Writer did not do well on that. I guess WordStar didn't do too well on the IBM PC either.
Well, WordStar per se, you know, they hadn't enhanced. They weren't pushing. And they came up with this great WordStar 2000 scheme.
Yeah.
You can find more. That was their intended successor product.
Gosh.
You can find more than I know about this on the web.
Yeah. WordStar never had a graphical.
I found you.
It never moved into the graphical interface world of pull-down menus. Mouse.
What was the scheme behind 2000? I mean, what were they trying to?
They were trying to make a next generation word processor. But there was the conflict between the venture capitalists that Seymour had sold out to and what Seymour thought should be done. And the guiding genius died of AIDS early in the development project.
Did you know him?
They met him at a meeting once. Okay. But no, because I wasn't working there.
When you saw WordPerfect and the other systems, what did you think of them?
I banged on WordPerfect, and rather than looking at what it did for the user, I looked at how the interface was coded, and I thought it was a piece of shit. Mm. You could put the cursor and arrow over places in the screen and type things, and then you get ignored. And to me, as a programmer, I always thought you should try to make the thing bulletproof.
Before
you start, before you give it to anybody. If the person does something random, you do nothing.
So you could crash it by just...
No, it just got ignored.
Oh, okay.
You couldn't crash it. It may have really worked perfectly well. I mean, as a user, I notice I don't judge programs this way. Oh. But I never tried to be a WordPerfect user. I just was amazed. But they apparently won on things like having good boilerplate for lawyers.
Yeah.
Good boilerplate packages. Yeah. You know, getting closer to the user, which was something, you know, that an organization would do, but I wouldn't try to do personally because I don't know nothing about what lawyers want out of their word processing.
Yeah. Well, what was the...
some lawyers to do that.
What was the hardest part of working, designing WordStar?
What was the hardest part? Nothing comes to mind.
Is there an easy...
As being especially hard.
So it was all pretty clear.
Yeah. Well, later when I did mail merge, making that work without new commands.
And that was a whole major addition to it, wasn't it? That's where you could create mailing labels.
And you could put them in the document, right? You could generate a letter of personalized letters?
Yeah, merge addresses and stuff.
So you worked on mail merge too, then, right?
Yeah, I did the original version of that. But what was hard was making it, because after it merges, it had to reformat. Hmm. You know, it had to readjust the line breaks, potentially. And what was hard was making it know how wide the lines should be, because when you formatted the stuff originally, the information was never recorded. Hmm. You know, when you formatted in WordStar, you gave a screen command, and it did it right while you waited.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't embed the margin, the information on the margins or anything else in the file. You know, there was a set left margin command, a set right margin command, and a reformat to the end of the paragraph. And I put a lot of work into making it scan quite a bit of the document and trying to guess what the margins were and where they changed. Because the text, if it wasn't justified, the text didn't reflect the margins. The text was shorter than the margins, so you have to take the longest line.
Mm-hmm.
And I think ultimately that didn't work out. I think later people changed it so that when you typed a margin command, it embedded it in the file. Which would make it much simpler to reformat while doing mail merge. Your most typical example is you don't need to reformat because you're putting the address in at the top of a letter or something, but I don't like partial solutions. You know, I wanted to be able to embed anything anywhere. You know, often you want to put the Barnaby family in the middle of a running paragraph. And the word Barnaby might be the last name could have a wide range of length variation, and I thought it should word wrap to the end of the paragraph in that case.
Well, I use the program a lot. I like mail merge.
Okay. worked for you.
He didn't work for me. Because I wasn't that sophisticated. He used to compare to some.
What sure. What version were you using?
I couldn't tell you. This part was 1980.
Yeah, I think 2.0 went out with the mail merge, and 3.0 was the first one on the PC.
Yeah. I had a psychic housemate who channeled on WordStar. Wrote whole documents without even being trans. So I saw one interesting.
Okay. But WordStar wasn't part of the channel. It was the way of recording.
It was. It allowed the flow. Allowed her to just type and not have to think about, you know, returns and stuff like that. And get into.
I see what you mean. Yeah, she could have dictated.
She got into the channel groove without having to think about it, and that allowed her to do a thing. And it was very successful. So WordStar allowed that to happen from its Word department. Is when we put out the Physicians Microcomputer Network, a big proposal for putting together an internet for doctors in 1980.
Okay.
It was all done on WordStar.
We've been doing that for years. I mean, we were doing it at BBN in the 60s. They're still talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, you see stuff about how, some whole town in Iowa or somewhere has gotten all of its doctors and hospitals on online medical records, and people can look at their own, and every doctor can read every other one.
Yeah, and Google's now working on it.
So what brought you to leave WordStar? MicroPro, I guess. How did that end?
I wanted to back off, and I didn't have a way to slow down. I've been working really hard for several years, so I had to leave completely. But I think we with a different deal saying, I need some space, maybe I'm not going to do anything much in the next 6 months, probably could have stayed. But.
Yeah. Well, this is an amicable departure then?
Yeah, reasonably so. I went back later. Well, they had yet another building in San Diego. It was in San Rafael. I don't even remember where it was, but I remember going to yet another building when I was doing the... Oh, this Rick Meyer went to work for them. And he got me to adopt, probably an obsolete by then, WordStar to run on this laptop without a disk. I turned to that, and then I worked part-time for a while with Seymour and brainstormed, and nothing ever quite came together.
You mean about what's next kind of thing?
Yeah.
This was after the IBM was out?
Yeah. And at one point, then I thought I wanted control over my own code. I remember, and I quit and bought an IBM PC. And it never went anywhere with my coding efforts.
That was
a chance to slow down and have more of a life.
Yeah. That's good. Sounds to me like you were pretty much a code focused on your work until then.
Yeah.
At that point. Yeah. Were you still living in Berkeley at the house that you had fixed up?
No. Oh, let's see. Yeah, 84, I moved to San Francisco.
84?
Yeah. So I was still living in Berkeley. Living in Berkeley when I left. And when I worked a little more stuff for my brother.
And then that was a shift in your focus, then you got more into lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
84.
Mm-hmm.
Did you still work then, or was it you just used the money you saved up for all those
just
years?
Just pretty much lived the money I saved up.
Yeah.
I had a stock option with MicroPro, which 1 year got vested. That made a bunch of money. Most of which I kept the stock and it went to nothing. Most of which was lost.
Yeah. Well, whatever happened to MicroPro?
They sold out to somebody who sold out to somebody who sold out to somebody, .. Mattel Toys. Mattel Toys bought them.
Really?
And I have, I believe, 100 shares of Mattel toy stock that came from my last of my MicroPro stock.
Oh, yeah, so that's where it ended up being.
But it went through the learning company or somebody was in there, and some company. Remember, there was a time when suddenly you saw huge quantities of software in the stores. There'd be these things that unfolded like multiple postcards for tourists.
Accordion
except
postcards?
Yeah, it was accordion CDs. Wow. When the CDs first came out, and there was a company that produced a bunch of them. Huh. Yeah. Somebody who had this idea first bought a lot of random software from different people and made these things and put them in supermarkets or something. Wow. and then I saw the software really where it was crap, but they made a bunch of money selling them.
Because it seemed like a lot for the money, huh?
Yeah.
And that included WordStar?
No, I don't think it ever included WordStar. I bought a word processor at Sears Roebuck on a disk that way once, I remember. I don't think I ever bothered to run it. But I was sort of interested. Sears Roebuck had a word processor for $13.95 or whatever it was. Yeah. I think it was a floppy. But,
did MicroPro have much of a corporate culture? I mean, like you hear by Apple or Microsoft or anything?
Probably more later.
More later, huh?
More, because I was working largely at home. And
yeah, so you kind of like the home office. You sort of helped pioneer that home office idea. Do you use a modem to send in your code?
When did that cross over? No, back then. Because you're sending in any reasonable amount of stuff, you know, at 1024 or 2048. You know, if you want to send a diskette full, you can get it there faster by car.
Yeah.
Right, I guess so.
But, it was...
Because I had a 300 baud modem in my S100 system.
Yeah.
File stories with.
Yeah, how long did it take to send a diskette?
Well, I usually did stories. I mean, they're usually much smaller than a diskette.
Right? Yeah, WordStar was a whole box of diskettes.
30K or something like that.
Each overlay was a separate diskette.
Yeah, that would take a while.
Yeah, there was a megabyte or something of code in it.
Yeah.
Of source code. And no, I didn't send that over the modem. I made a copy of the pilot diskettes and put them in my saddlebag and rode my motorcycle over there.
Oh, cool.
Or something.
Cool. But, over the Richmond San Rafael Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Point Richmond. So you basically I guess the early sneaker net for you then.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess when it really crossed over, it was getting DSL. I mean, now it's easy to work remotely on somebody else's system using a source control system.
You must have been, you must not have had that many friends that had computers at home.
No.
Back in that time, right? So it's still a pretty rare phenomenon.
Yeah, internet and DSL, it must have been, 98 or something by the time I hit all that.
Yeah, most computers had no modems then. Did you have any idea at the time that word processors would become so pervasive as where everybody would be using them?
It became obvious because that was about the first program you start meeting people you know not through work, and they've bought a PC and are doing word processing.
Mm-hmm. So
it was a very widely used thing. Yeah, I mean, you still run into people that say they're the first time a computer became useful to them personally was when they got WordStar on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But whereas I heard about SuperSort for a long time, and my text editors didn't particularly stick. I mean, they're much newer Unix editors.
Yeah.
As you hear about since then.
Hmm. So are you credited then with creating WordStar?
Yeah, as far as I know. We need to give Seymour credit for the idea of doing a word processor and for starting with putting word wrap into it.
Uh-huh. So he had some of the conceptual feature list that he wanted to put
together. Yeah, well, he was looking at what he could sell. Yeah. I was just looking at doing interesting coding and getting somebody to pay me for it.
Yeah, and thanks to that.
But so implementation-wise, I created it with, of course, things like the file structure that were revolved from the CPM editor.
Hmm. Everything is
correct. With the addition of the backup file.
Thanks to your friendship from MSI days, and you're able to pursue this with him, creating a software that is a milestone in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very cool. So was that it for you for software for a while? I mean, you went into exploring quality of life and your social
quality of life, and then I wanted to make some money, and often my brother had something interesting to participate in.
Yeah, he was a bit of an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I've been back to that a few times. The company he formed wound down and the partnership split, and he got a job with a company called Zenergy that did almost anything to do with energy, and they had an office in Oakland.
So that was a constant dream of his, is to really have a breakthrough in this whole energy.
No, he liked to program. He became, like program. You know, he's...
So he was like you. He was a programmer, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, and the stuff he was doing about energy conservation hasn't found much funding and didn't really get into the... Well, the government funding dwindled and it didn't get into the mainstream.
Yeah. What about today?
He ended up...
resurgence in the
area. He ended up doing some stuff in that area for Zenergy, and then he moved on. Now he's called Chief Scientist or something. No, that was my title. No, I was called Software Scientist. He's Chief Scientist, I think, at a company that does something mundane, designs HVAC systems.
HVAC, yeah.
I mean, make software for designing HVACs, you know, because now it's at the level that you can sell it to every contractor in the country.
Oh, well.
You know, because it's really, really easy to use. You can put fancy, flashy graphics in it. Mm-hmm. The simulation-based computations that used to take hours can be done in seconds.
Wow. Well, so that's very pragmatic.
Yeah, they put a lot of rules of thumb into the thing. I mean, the main application, they sell you draw a rough outline of your building, mm-hmm. and then tune it up if you want. And then you say, put the ducts in, and it draws them. Mm. And then you move them around to where you really want them. Mm. You know, it's one of the differences. I would have made the user draw them. But one of the ways they make it simple is it puts all the ducts in by default, you know, in the middle of the ceiling in each room or something. And then maybe you really want them by the windows, so you drag them with your mouse.
Gotcha, yeah.
You know, and you get this so it looks right, and then it prints a parts list. You know, but there's a... and it's got additional models for, what do you call them, when you bury a coil in the ground for the other end of your air conditioning. Instead of putting it in the air, one of the new things is you put it in the ground. Ground source. You know, it's apparently hard to calculate and design. Hmm. But it doesn't heat up as fast as the air. Hmm. You know, it's advantageous as a heat sink for the other end of a heat pump, whether you're heating or cooling. You know, you cool the ground in the winter and heat it in the summer. I'm not on their mailing list.
A whole other world, though.
What they're doing. Yeah. On the one hand, it's mundane. On the other hand, it's stuff you can effectively do with a PC now.
Yeah.
Okay. Whereas the stuff he was doing in the... late 70s, early 80s was a little more arcane. I mean, it wasn't... You could sort of do it if you really wanted to do it that way, but it wasn't clear that your average architect thinking about how to design the house rather than how to operate the computer could easily come up with a design that saved much energy.
Gotcha. Well, is there anything you'd like to say about the history of this whole project that we haven't covered? No.
Let's see, just to go on for myself, I worked with a few different things with my brother, and I've done nothing for quite a while, and mm-hmm. now I'm doing nothing again. I've never done anything with the company he works for now.
So you're semi-retired? Or
yeah, I'd call myself retired. Yeah. I was by default retired for many of the years in the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm. So what's your lifestyle like now?
What's my lifestyle like now? We bought the house in the country with a man I met in about 2002. Okay. And I'm learning to grow plants.
Yeah.
Hmm. And I guess it's a chance to come back and use the stuff I learned when I was doing houses in the 70s. I mean, we put in a bathroom. I never did tile before.
Okay.
I'm very pleased with how it came out.
A lot of pragmatic skills here.
And just a bunch of work keeping the body working. Mm-hmm. I mean, we heat with wood, so you have to go out and cut a bunch of it every year.
Yeah.
You better spend money on it.
Yeah.
But I need to learn how to make a lawn not turn brown like that.
How not to do that?
Yeah. One thing I've discovered is once it turns brown when you water it, the grass doesn't come back, just a lot of weeds come up.
Oh.
Now, I don't know if you just need to water it automatically steadily through the season or you need to plant different grass.
So what should he do here, plant some new seeds?
I don't know. What I know is my stuff did that. That's the next thing I want to know. I mean, the next thing to try is to have the watering be automatic and be sure you started easy enough.
Right. At least have the basics covered.
Yeah. Well, to decide where you want grass and where you want to let it grow. I mean, we've got far more field than I'm going to water.
Yeah, you got some land around me.
Yeah.
Are you going alternative energy at all?
And they would heat with wood.
Heat with wood, yeah.
But I don't have the dedication to hang my clothes on a clothesline.
Or solar energy and wind?
Oh, the house is passive solar. So it needs less heat and less cooling. Yeah. But,
Photovoltaic?
And one of the things about photovoltaics is we don't have any south-facing roofs.
Oh, okay.
Roof tips north and overhangs just enough to keep the sun off the two-story high windows in the middle of the summer, but let the sun into the entire main room in the winter. Hmm. Doesn't do anything for you before 10 o'clock in the morning. If you wake up and want it warm, you still have to make a fire.
Yeah.
It has its limitations. And it tends to be too cool in the spring or too hot in the fall. Hmm. You know, because the time when the air is warmest is a couple of months after the time when the sun is furthest up. Right now, the sun is highest in the sky, but the hottest time will be at the beginning of August or something.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can do in a purely passive geometric design to compensate for that. And of course, we didn't build it, but it's a fairly recent house, built in the 80s. It's got 6-inch walls and lots of insulation.
That's pretty well.
Double glass everywhere.
Do you get winter weather up there?
Mm-hmm. Some. Yeah. Some. There was a, just before we got the place, there was a snow a foot deep. Mm-hmm. They said that was a 30-year snow.
Wow.
It was very,
cross-country skiing and stuff.
I guess. Tree branches down all over the roads.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of branches down on our property that look like they probably came down then.
Wow.
I mean, just somehow this branch got too much weight on it and it broke. Mm. I mean, usually live tree branches don't do that. They come down after they die because the higher branches are blocking the sun. Mm. But these are branches that obviously broke off when they had all their leaves on them.
Yeah, wow. So that is quite a transition from San Francisco to live out there.
Mm-hmm.
But you have power, at least. And what about computers? You're using a PC, you're saying, right? Your laptops today?
Yeah, I've got one little cheap consumer laptop.
Yeah.
And Wi-Fi and broadband in both houses, so you just open up the computer and it works.
Nice. Right. So what word processor you use today? Word?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it took a long time, but I've gotten comfortable enough with Word. It's easier than writing my own and having to rewrite it every few years.
I guess.
And not being able to deal with anybody else's documents.
I guess it's become the de facto. Of course, there's Open Office, which is...
especially explored. Yeah. I find mostly I don't go for a lot of variety in software. Because there are very few things I use enough to remember how to use.
Hmm. So you use, for your browser, do you use Firefox?
Just been using Internet Explorer.
Explorer, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what the advantages are, except maybe it's desirable not to support Microsoft exclusively.
Well, there are less exploits on Firefox. Apparently, people have targeted.
There's less security is better on a non-standard one. Yeah, that makes sense. And something turned up on my computer that I realized later was Apple's new browser.
Safari?
Safari, yeah.
It just turned up, huh?
I failed to clear a checkbox when I was downloading an iTunes update.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, they will do that.
Yes. And and then one time my computer got so it took entirely too long to boot, and I went through looking for startup things to delete and just applications to delete. Mm. I got rid of about half of them and have lost almost no functionality. That's one of the nice things about the MSI. It boots much faster. takes about a second.
So you're running XP? Forget this new.
My first reaction is wait a year and see what people say. Yeah, and I don't hear a lot of enthusiasm.
That's for sure.
XP works. It's pretty soon it's going to be hard to find a new computer that doesn't come with Vista on it.
Yeah, true. I think we stopped officially. supporting XP.
Oh, well, okay.
Or installing it on new machines. Anyway.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it still gets updates from somewhere.
Yeah, it gets updates, but they have SP3, I think. Okay. Cool. Well, good. Interesting evolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a casual user. I mean, what I want out of a computer doesn't grow anywhere near as fast as the computer power grows. Because I don't do video with it. I don't do images very seriously.
Well, you said you use an iPod?
I do put my pictures into it. But what I use the iPods for is so I don't have to carry CDs around.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've got one iPod I can put in my pocket, and I've got, this started when I got a second house.
Yeah.
You know, I've got two stereo systems in each house, and each one of them has a little plug hanging out of it that plugs into the iPod. And I guess the only reason not to have four iPods is that when you get a new CD, you'd have to put it four places. Hmm. Or sync them all.
Yeah.
But the CDs are all in a box in the attic somewhere.
Yeah, so end of an era.
If you lose both the iPod and your hard disk, you need them again.
Then you go back, yeah.
In
the car, maybe. Maybe you have a CD player in the car.
But I've got a little FM thing that broadcasts the iPod on the truck, which is a cheap radio.
Yeah.
And then our SUV, which costs more, has a place for a plug.
Yeah. Also it has
Yeah,
right. All the new ones. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. His Honda Element has a place apparently to plug one in.
Well,
but actually, it's kind of nice once in a while to listen to commercial radio.
Yeah.
I never listen to radio at home, and almost anything on the TV is delayed through the TiVo when you skip the commercials. Mm-hmm. It's sort of part of getting back in the culture to keep in contact with the culture too when you're driving somewhere and listen to the ads.
Yeah, yeah. The ads and the news and the fires going on everywhere and all that kind of stuff.
That's true. We don't get enough local news either because we get PBS news. Oh no, there's smoke in the sky. Maybe we should listen to the Sacramento news.
Yeah,
see where it's burning.
See how close it's getting.
Yeah, or call up my friend with all the scanners.
Yeah.
And he will have listened to it all. If it's burning anywhere in the county, he'll know where it is.
Exactly. And your ham radio friends and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, good. Okay, well, thank you for the download here. We appreciate that.
Okay.
That's today on
26,
2008, I believe.
Right, that sounds right.